Hello there. Today is Thursday, July 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. labor chief defends his role in the sex trafficking case.
I'm not here to try to say that I can stand in their shoes or that I can address their concerns.
The UK ambassador to the U.S. resigns amid a dispute with President Trump. Also ahead, a New York parade honors World Cup winning U.S. women's soccer team. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta Wednesday addressed a non-prosecution agreement he signed off on more than 10 years ago with financier Jeffrey Epstein, who has now been charged with sex trafficking in underage girls. The deal came under fresh scrutiny after a Miami Herald investigation shed new light on it, spurring federal prosecutors in New York this week to file new sex trafficking charges against Epstein. Despite calls from Democrats for Acosta to step down, he gave no indication he would resign and said that he has the support of President Trump. Joining us to talk more about it is attorney and professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University, Robert Deitz. Did Acosta make his case for keeping his job?
As you know, the president has said what a great guy Acosta is. Unfortunately, Mr. Trump, that often precedes then the guy getting fired. So, you know, we just don't know at this stage.
Acosta, of course, is under investigation for how he handled Mr. Epstein more than 10 years ago. And he really went on the defensive in a news conference to try to basically say that, everything he did was absolutely the way it should have been done. What do you say?
It's often hard to judge a prosecution once the case is over. You tend to see this in notorious cases. But there were really two problems. One is they dropped a federal suit in favor of a state prosecution. And Epstein got a very kind of light sentence for what he was alleged to have done. There have been claims that there were witness problems. The thing is there were at least, I think, 30 young girls claimed that they had been abused. The other point is that it kind of smells that Epstein has lots of powerful friends. And the concern is that those powerful friends influenced the way the case was handled.
The deal that Acosta apparently made with Epstein's attorneys all those years ago is coming under fresh scrutiny after an article in the Miami Herald brought new light. And this, of course, spurred federal prosecutors to file new sex trafficking charges against Epstein. This agreement, a non-prosecution agreement, that's also under scrutiny in and of itself is being looked at. What can you say about this deal that was made?
Well, once a deal has been made by prosecutors with a defendant, nothing can be done about that defendant on those cases. That's kind of a long, long principle. However, the prosecutor who entered into that kind of deal can be examined, and there are a couple of problems with Acosta's prosecution. The most glaring is that there's a federal act that requires prosecutors in federal cases to speak with alleged victims, about the deal. And it doesn't give victims a veto right, but it does give them the opportunity to say, wait a minute, that's unfair, or that's not right, or complain about it on any grounds. And Acosta failed to do that.
Mm.
And that's serious. And it's hard to understand why he would do that. He was an experienced prosecutor.
Well, in his press conference, he made the case that things were different in 2008, and that sort of implying that he was trying to protect these people, but some have argued that no victim is comfortable doing that, but they also want to be able to have justice served and to be able to make their case.
Yes, I interpret what he said somewhat differently. That is, I think what he was saying is this was all before Me Too, and therefore you shouldn't hold me, you shouldn't take a stick to me. Well, I think that's a ridiculous argument. I mean, nobody prior to the Me Too movement ever claimed that rape was okay, or having, so-called statutory rape, that is sexual intercourse with kids under a certain age, that was okay. And so, I find that a really, really weak argument.
there is a Department of Justice Office of Professional Responsibility investigation alleging misconduct by department lawyers and how Acosta and other prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida handled the deal. Would that put him in legal jeopardy?
I don't think so. What it puts in jeopardy is his reputation. And to a lawyer, that's a big deal.
The plea deal in 2008 was on a lesser charge of prostitution, but when he was asked by reporters in his news conference if he would consider what these girls were doing prostitution, he said no,
right.
Meaning you can't be a prostitute if you're a minor. It's sort of confusing how you would get a prostitution charge or something dropped to a prostitution charge, which is a much more lenient than a sex offender or sex trafficking.
Absolutely. The plea was in state court, and Acosta, of course, was the federal prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't have to account for that fact, you know, in a legal way, but he certainly does have to account for it in kind of a moral way. And what they did was the feds, the FBI, were looking into it, and therefore, as was the federal prosecutors. But ultimately, the deal that emerged was a plea to a state count, meaning the prostitution charge, and the dropping of the entire federal investigation.
Oh, that was part of the agreement, to
that
drop it.
That was part of the agreement, yes.
All right, that's Robert Deitz. He is an attorney and professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Thanks for being with us. A transatlantic controversy surrounds the departure of Britain's ambassador to the U.S., Kim DeRoche, who resigned Wednesday after making candid and unflattering remarks about U.S. President Donald Trump in classified diplomatic cables. His comments were leaked to news media on Sunday. Trump then tweeted his displeasure with both DeRoche and outgoing British Prime Minister Theresa May. Arash Arabasadi reports.
A career diplomat, Kim Derrick served as ambassador to the U.S. since 2016, but no more. This past weekend, the Daily Mail reported on leaked diplomatic cables in which Derrick called President Trump insecure and incompetent. Trump responded Monday, tweeting insults about Derrick and disparaging outgoing British Prime Minister Theresa May's handling of Brexit.
The Prime Minister.
In Parliament, May praised the ambassador.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I have spoken to Sir Kim Darroch. I have told him that it is a matter of great regret that he has felt it necessary to leave his position as ambassador in Washington. Sir Kim has given a lifetime of service to the United Kingdom, and we owe him an enormous debt of gratitude.
Members of Parliament gave the ambassador broad support.
And I think the whole House should join together in deeply regretting the feeling that he's obviously got that he must resign at this moment.
Monday, on a debate stage in Manchester, the leading candidates for Britain's next Prime Minister addressed the fallout of the leaked cables.
Sometimes things that you have to say to your friends that you'd rather not say, like I said to President Trump today, because I think his comments about Theresa May were unacceptable, and I don't think he should have made them.
I think it is absolutely vital that the advice that civil servants give to ministers should not be leaked by ministers and should not be commented on by ministers if civil servants are going to feel free to give that advice with the impartiality that they want.
In Washington Wednesday, Congressman Adam Schiff, a vocal Trump critic, released in a statement that the president's continued attempts to bully our allies and their diplomats undermine the work of the men and women we send overseas to represent the United States, a statement echoed by a former U.S. diplomat, Alexander Virchow.
But it certainly sets a very bad example of having the head of state of the United States being able to basically expel the ambassador of our closest ally.
Theresa May will step down as prime minister after the election of her successor, likely in the coming weeks. In the meantime, May's office ordered an investigation into the source of the leaked cables. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump says the U.S. will substantially increase Iran's sanctions. Germany's Angela Merkel insists she is well after a third public trembling spell. Sudan's mobile internet is restored after power-sharing deal. And demonstrations in Hong Kong will continue as protesters call for the chief executive to do more. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Two members of the United Nations Human Rights Council have signed a joint letter leveling criticism against China's actions in its own Xinjiang region. The UN's own experts, along with many other reports, say China is housing 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslims in detention camps in the western area. China claims those being held are being educated in what they call vocational training centers. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about it with Luis Charbonneau, UN Director for Human Rights Watch.
The Chinese government has been bullying countries and international officials, including UN officials, to not criticize it. Countries have been very reluctant. Countries in the region and around the world have been very reluctant to openly criticize China because of its economic clout. If you anger the Chinese government because of what it's doing in Xinjiang and these massive human rights abuses, which have nothing to do with counterterrorism and everything to do with the persecution of an ethnic minority across the entire Xinjiang region. If you do that, then the Chinese government will threaten retaliation.
Why would just more countries signing on have any further effect than has already happened?
What's important here is that the number of countries that are willing to put their names on this is growing. And we hope that the number of countries that have signed on to this particular statement will continue to grow because it's still open for signing. We would like to see a country like Turkey signing on as well because they have been outspoken in the past. And they have been threatened with retaliation by the Chinese government. We're not expecting that this is going to push Beijing to close the camps tomorrow, but it is increasing the cost for the Chinese government. But there's still a lot more that we need to be done. We've had a few countries raising the issue in, for example, the Security Council, and we're not holding our breath for the Security Council to do anything because China has a veto there, which they don't have in the Human Rights Council. But we would like more discussion of it in the Security Council. Germany and the U.S. raised it recently, and according to media reports, the Chinese delegation was furious about it. We would also like the Human Rights Council to create a fact-finding mission so that we can know exactly what's going on in these camps and also get details on other human rights abuses in the Xinjiang region. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has been negotiating with the Chinese government on the terms of access for a visit to the camps, but so far they haven't been able to reach an agreement. We were quite disappointed that Secretary General Antonio Guterres decided to send his top counterterrorism official, Under Secretary General Voronkov, to visit the camps, confirming China's false narrative that this is about counterterrorism and not about human rights abuses on a scale that has not been seen since the days of the Soviet gulags. So by sending a counterterrorism official as the first high-level UN official to Xinjiang, it's helping to bolster the Chinese narrative that this is about fighting terrorism. That is not the case. What we have here is human rights abuses, and that's why Michelle Bachelet needs to be able to go there with her team of experts, terms that she considers acceptable, so that they can make a credible and independent evaluation of what's going on. So we would like the Secretary General to tell the Chinese government to make sure she gets the terms that she wants.
I'm looking at the countries that are signatories to the agreement so far. See a bunch of them, but I don't see the United States. What's the situation there?
There are many countries missing that should be there. The U.S. has been speaking out about it, but they should sign on. I would certainly hope that the Trump administration would not allow the fact that it pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council last year in a very short-sighted decision because they didn't want it to criticize Israel. So I hope that the U.S. will swallow its pride and sign on to this if they haven't already.
All right, that is Louis Charbonneau, UN Director for Human Rights Watch, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. With the rise in nationalism worldwide, there are fears that it is non-inclusive and based on racism, but some argue that's only one sector of the larger philosophy behind nationalism. In an opinion article this week in the conservative newspaper, The Washington Times, one analyst says it's not a dirty word. It's also the topic of an event this weekend in Washington that hopes to promote the principles of what it calls national conservatism in Western and other democratic countries. Joining us to talk more about the article that he wrote and the broader issue is Clifford May, founder and president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. You know, it is pretty apparent, obviously, with the election of Donald Trump, who, it, by all indications, considers himself a nationalist, and, of course, what's happening across Europe. You're writing a question in your op-ed, but I would ask the same thing. Is this a new age of nationalism that is already upon us? And if so, what does it say and what does it mean?
What I think is happening is there is sort of a reascendence of nationalism taking place. You can see it in, you can see it in Europe. You can certainly see it in America. President Trump has identified himself as a nationalist. And then he's added to that that I know you're not supposed to use that word, but I intend to persist in doing so. If you look at Brexit, I think one could say that that is an expression of nationalism, the idea of breaking away from the European Union so that people of Britain, the British people, can make decisions for themselves. I've been to Hungary recently, and certainly Hungary is considered a place where nationalism is on the rise. It manifests itself there by Viktor Orban, who's the president, saying, I want to remain in the European Union, but I don't want to be dictated to by either bureaucrats in Brussels or by Angela Merkel, because Germany is the richest and most powerful nation in Europe. I want to be able to make my own decisions and have the people of Hungary make their own decisions. Now, there's a tremendous resistance to nationalism from really across the political spectrum. Certainly from certain people on the far right, libertarians, people on the far left. I saw a magazine online called Jacobite, which is very far left, which had a 3,000-word attack on Yoram Hazony, who's the author of a book called The Virtue of Nationalism. It appeared last week, and he is also the organizer of a big conference coming up in Washington starting on Sunday, running through Tuesday, on the subject of nationalism, and he's the founder of a new fledgling institute called the Edmund Burke Institute, and he's arguing that nationalism is where conservatism needs to be going. Liberal internationalists oppose it, people like my friend Robert Kagan. So it's a controversial issue now, mm-hmm. And I think we need to, what I'm trying to do in the article I have, my column in the Washington Times this week, is to say, what is nationalism and what are the other options, the alternatives to nationalism, and which is the least bad?
Well, I'm reading here what you've written about being of the mind that that is the way of conservatism in the West and other democratic countries. Some would argue that it's not inclusive, that it the word nationalism is often equated with white nationalism, white supremacists.
Yeah, I'm perfectly willing to say, and I do say in the article, that nationalism carries dangers, that nationalism can be taken to fanatical extremes, but I'm not sure it necessarily has to. I'm not sure that that's always the case. If you go to a place like Hungary, they would say, yes, we are nationalists. We are Hungarian nationalists. That means that we want this nation to survive. That doesn't mean we don't have minorities in this country. We do. We want our minorities integrated, assimilated, feeling as much part of the nation as possible. But there are always going to be minorities, and they can be treated well or they can be treated badly. That's not the same thing. You'll hear people say, and the good argument, that certainly nationalism in Germany in the 1930s led to terrible things, but what it really led to was empire. The Third Reich meant the Third Empire. It was beyond nationalism, meaning the survival of an independent, sovereign, self-ruling nation state. It meant empire, that the German Reich was going to conquer and rule all of its neighbors. What Yoram certainly says in his book, The Virtue of Nationalism, is, look, nationalism is one way to organize the world order, independent, sovereign, self-ruling nation.
All right, that's Clifford May, founder and president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you for being with us. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. The triumphant U.S. women's national soccer team, home after winning their fourth World Cup championship in France, was honored in Wednesday by the city of New York with a parade through the streets of Lower Manhattan. Construction workers, motorcyclists, and even little girls waving flags greeted team members. The U.S. women won their second straight World Cup title with a 2-0 victory last Sunday over the Netherlands. Team co-captain Megan Rapinoe, speaking to a roaring crowd, said she couldn't be more proud of the diversity in her team.
We have pink hair and purple hair. We have tattoos and dreadlocks. We got white girls and black girls and everything in between. Straight girls and gay girls. Hey!
Well, VOA's Adam Phillips was on the parade route in New York and talked about the celebration with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson.
So let's talk about this parade. What was it like?
It was so exciting. I mean, downtown New York City, where the financial district is usually kind of a very serious place, but the place was just completely over the top with joy and confetti and balloons and signs, and just people just seemed so incredibly happy, especially girls and women.
What were the fans saying? How were they reacting?
Well, there were different levels of it. On one hand, they were just excited that the USA had won and that you know, the team was so excellent and people were so proud kind of as Americans. And, of course, the New York aspect is very iconic to have a ticker tape parade. But I think the really standout comment from girls and boys, men and women, was how proud they were that these women were unapologetically excellent and that they had really shown the world what women can do when they really set their minds to it. And it was funny because one 9-year-old boy that I spoke to with, he is a soccer player, he said, I think that these women should coach the men's World Cup team because they really know what they're doing. The men, maybe not so much, at least in recent years.
Oh, my, that's adorable. Now, you mentioned the whole ticker tape parade symbolism there. Tell us a little bit about what that means in New York.
It's a huge deal in New York because it's called the Canyon of Heroes. That's the name of it. And the first one was a spontaneous celebration in 1886 when the Statue of Liberty was first commemorated. And then after that, war heroes and all kinds of, you know, other heroes, explorers and astronauts and others came to the fore. Anybody that a mayor really wants to honor, they get a ticker tape parade up Broadway from the harbor, basically, all the way up to City Hall, where they're usually given a key to the city, as happened today as well.
This team of women football players, soccer players, they've really made a mark. And the U.S. women have sort of led the World Cup competition since it began. I think this is now the 8th World Cup for women. What does that say about women in sports? How are people responding to that?
Well, this is this just to be clear, this is the fourth time the women have won the World Cup, and the second time they've been given a ticker tape parade. 2015, they also had one. I think it shows that not only are women able to excel on the playing field with men, and that women sports should be taken very, very seriously and are a lot of fun, and there's a lot of skill involved. But that soccer itself, football, as it's called in the rest of the world, is really coming into its own here in the United States. And so it's kind of a vindication both for football and soccer players, as well as people who feel that women have a place at the table just like men do.
All right. That was VOA's Adam Phillips in New York speaking with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. Willie Nelson, John Mellencamp, Neil Young, Dave Matthews, and more will headline Farm Aid 2019 when the Music and Food Festival visits Wisconsin's struggling dairy country in September. Farm Aid said in Tuesday's announcement that the U.S. farming economy this year resembles how things were when Willie Nelson founded Farm Aid in 1985, with low prices, devastating weather, and harmful trade policies. Farm Aid has raised $57 million to support family farms since 1985. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 1, 2018, four cases of Ebola virus disease were confirmed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC. Since then, health officials have reported at least 2,408 confirmed and probable cases of Ebola in the country's North Kivu and Ituri provinces. Over 1,600 people have died. To date, this is the worst Ebola epidemic recorded in the DRC and the second largest recorded outbreak of the disease globally. The United States quickly responded to the new health emergency. In September 2018, just about 1 month after the new outbreak was confirmed in the DRC, the United States declared the outbreak an emergency and bolstered its support by deploying a Disaster Assistance Response Team, or DART, to the DRC. Comprised of disaster and health experts from the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the DART team began to coordinate the U.S. government response to the outbreak, while working closely with local officials, the international community, and relief agencies. In June 2019, USAID Administrator Mark Green and U.S. Ambassador to the DRC Michael Hammer traveled to North Kivu Province, where they met with healthcare workers at an Ebola treatment unit in Katwa, community and local leaders at the Emergency Operations Center in Butembo, and response groups working to stop the spread of the disease. Following Administrator Green's visit, USAID announced publicly it has provided $98 million thus far to help the Democratic Republic of the Congo and international partners fight the Ebola outbreak. The funds are going toward life-saving assistance such as infection prevention and control activities, training for healthcare workers, community engagement interventions, promotion of safe and dignified burials, and food assistance for people and communities affected by Ebola. This assistance is also helping to prepare communities in Goma, the capital of North Kivu Province, and other neighboring areas of the DRC at high risk for Ebola spread. The way that you defeat this deadly virus is to harness the strength, the connections, and the spirit of every part of the community. Every part of the community is affected. Every part of the community must be in the response. And that is, to me, the most important thing, said USAID Administrator Green. With all of the challenges, and there are many, there is nothing that is insurmountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.